We'll take a look at the numbers. From the Odessa American, Ector County total cases, both confirmed and probable, 4,686. Ector County negative, 22,250 out of 27,262 tested, with 326 pending, 94 deaths. Recovered, 3,982. Active, 610. Midland County, 3,588 confirmed, 81 deaths. From the Texas Standard, Texas adds more than 13,500 backlogged coronavirus cases to statewide total. 3,207 Texans are in the hospital for the coronavirus as of September 22nd, 104 less than a week ago. They occupy 5.7% of hospital beds. 3,964 new cases were reported on September 22nd. The latest positivity rate is 6.46%. 14,994 Texans have died as of September 22nd. 77 more deaths reported than the day before and 651 more than a week ago. Now here are coronavirus briefs. COVID-19 has killed more than 200,000 people in the United States, a number that seemed inconceivable in March when President Trump said that keeping the nation's death toll below 200,000 would constitute a very good job by his administration. The U.S. COVID-19 death toll is equivalent to 109 Hurricane Katrinas. America's reopened schools have so far not seemed to produce the explosive coronavirus outbreaks that many health experts feared. Johnson & Johnson just announced its one-dose vaccine has entered phase 3 of its trial. Coronavirus could be considered a pre-existing condition if Obamacare is struck down. If the Supreme Court strikes down Obamacare in November, insurers could resume discriminating against Americans with pre-existing medical conditions, just as they did before the law was passed. Democrats are loudly insisting that this is an especially dangerous prospect in a pandemic, as the coronavirus could be considered a pre-existing condition. Ruth Bader Ginsburg's death ups the chances the court will toss the Affordable Care Act when it hears a high-profile lawsuit on November 10th. The law guaranteed people the ability to buy coverage and required a comprehensive set of benefits in any plan they choose, banning insurers from denying coverage or charging more to people with pre-existing conditions such as diabetes or cancer. Absent the ACA, states could limit or not limit how insurers define a pre-existing condition. U.S. lawmakers set sights on CDC after latest mishap. The posting and removal of U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention guidelines on airborne transmission for coronavirus prompted a flurry of questions from Capitol Hill this week, with both sides of the aisle reaching out for answers on what happened. And Democrats were not buying the CDC's innocuous explanation of an unfortunate mistake. They argue it's just the latest example in a long pattern of confusing behavior, where the CDC makes one decision and then days later backs off. The CDC just published scientifically valid information and then pulled it off their website. And this is very likely a scandal, Senator Brian Schatz, a Democrat from Hawaii, said Tuesday. One way or another, we're going to investigate it and find out, Illinois Representative Raja Krishnamurthy, a Democrat on the House Oversight Committee, said. The CDC guidance pertained to the way the novel coronavirus is spread. While it's known that COVID-19 can spread through droplets among people standing less than 6 feet apart, research has continued to explore how the virus suspends in aerosolized particles in the air and transmits to people more than 6 feet away. The CDC said the retraction of the new guidance about airborne coronavirus transmission was the result of a confused staffer who hit publish without approval, according to the most detailed explanation yet of the agency's website mishap. Several other current and former federal health officials also told CNN the document was posted in error before it had gone through the full review process. Before we move on to our shorter articles, I'm going to read a slightly longer article that comes from The Hill, which relates to the previous story. Despair at CDC after Trump influence. I have never seen morale this low. The Trump administration's bungled response to the coronavirus pandemic and its subsequent efforts to meddle with recommendations from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are taking a substantial toll on the nation's foremost public health institution. In interviews with half a dozen current and former CDC officials, they described a workplace that has seen its expertise questioned, its findings overturned for political purposes, and its effectiveness in combating the pandemic undermined by partisan actors in Washington. I have never seen morale this low. It's just people are beaten down. People are beaten down partially by a public who not only distrusts us, but who actually think we want to infringe on their civil liberties, said one current CDC employee. The other factor is the active undermining by senior members of our own administration. Those who still work at the agency requested anonymity to describe their conversations among their colleagues for fear of retribution from an administration that has punished officials who speak out. They expressed frustration that the CDC, long an independent voice of dispassionate science, has bent to the whims of an administration that does not acknowledge the severity of a pandemic that has killed more than 200,000 people in the U.S. They have seen guidance revised or removed, most recently this week, when the CDC took down language that acknowledged the virus mainly spreads through aerosol droplets, something the World Health Organization said months ago. In the early months of the pandemic, senior CDC officials, including Principal Deputy Director Anne Schuchat and Nancy Messonnier, the director of the National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases, were sidelined after sounding the alarms over the dangers posed by the novel coronavirus. President Trump publicly downplayed and continues to downplay the pandemic, questioning both his own top medical and health experts and the science that shows mask mandates and social distancing work. In private, Trump acknowledged that the virus was far more deadly, according to interviews published by veteran journalist Bob Woodward. As I talk to former colleagues at CDC, the feeling I get is just an overwhelming sense of despair. People are working incredibly hard to reduce the impact of the pandemic, and the sense that they're being blocked by people at the political level and that the work they're doing is not being appreciated by the American public, said Rich Besser, a former CDC director who now runs the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. The feeling right now is that the public health is not being allowed to lead and to demonstrate the path forward to reduce transmission and increase economic activity, he said. CDC spokespeople did not return calls and emails seeking comment. Officials at the Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, have publicly questioned the CDC's conclusions, published in its Morbidity and Mortality Weekly report. Those reports are sacrosanct documents meant to highlight the agency's best work and research. House Democrats have launched an inquiry into potential political interference in the CDC's publications. The HHS officials who sought changes to those reports included Michael Caputo, who worked on Trump's campaign and who arrived at the health agency in April, and his top science advisor, Paul Alexander. Alexander has left the HHS, and Caputo has taken medical leave after a bizarre rant on Facebook in which he accused CDC officials of trying to harm Trump's political standing. Some current CDC employees pointed to a directive from HHS in August when guidance recommending that those who came in contact with someone infected by the virus be tested even if they were asymptomatic was quietly removed from the agency's website. That recommendation was reinstated after public outcry. It's horrifying. I don't know of any other situation like this when things have been dictated to be put on the CDC website that aren't defensible science. The idea that you shouldn't test contacts is just indefensible, said Tom Frieden, who led the CDC during the Obama administration. Political interference in guidance and Trump's pledges that a vaccine will be ready soon a promise that stands in contrast with CDC Director Robert Redfield's testimony to Congress last week that a vaccine would not be widely available until next year, is raising concerns over whether the public will accept a vaccine once it becomes available. It's incredibly sad to all of us that the recent guidance is causing a loss of trust for CDC in general. I'm very nervous about what is going to happen when a vaccine is available, especially if the Phase 3 trials are cut short for political reasons, said a current CDC employee. Public health messaging is so important, and it's been disregarded since the early days of the pandemic. Others at the CDC said political interference has been taking place from the first days of the pandemic. On one incident management call, an official who listened in said Redfield talked about how he had been instructed by Vice President Pence to change CDC guidelines on the size of public gatherings to come in line with the White House Coronavirus Task Force recommendations. A spokesperson for Pence's office denied that he instructed Redfield to change any guidance. But in March, the CDC changed its guidance from a limit on public gatherings from 50 to 10 people, 3 days after the White House's task force set the limit at 10. The current CDC employees said their faith in Redfield's leadership had been shaken, both by his inability to prevent changes to recommendations handed down from Washington and for his unwillingness to defend the agency more vociferously. Those employees called Redfield, a prominent AIDS researcher at the University of Maryland before he was tapped to head CDC, both humble and approachable. It's become quite obvious that Dr. Redfield is a meek and gentle guy in a context where a fighter was needed, the first CDC employee said. He is not seen by anybody at CDC as somebody who will stand up and fight for us as an agency. Even Redfield's predecessors have been critical of his defense of their agency. What does concern me is that we're not seeing strong support for the agency from the top, and that can be demoralizing. One role of the CDC director is to have the backs of the scientists and all of the people working hard across the agency, and we're not seeing that, Besser said. I don't know what Dr. Redfield is doing behind closed doors, but we haven't been hearing from him out front condemning interference in CDC publications. CDC sources said there had been no talk of mass resignations to protest the administration's handling of the pandemic or its meddling in public health science. Some have joked of moving to New Zealand or Australia, but most say they will continue their work to promote public health. People in public health, by and large, are people who just see suffering and want there to be less of it. That's what drives you into public health. I mean, God knows you don't do it for the money, the first CDC employee said. But the employee added, the overall tenor of things, the drumbeat, is just too disheartening. The public can trust the CDC and the FDA for coronavirus information, Fauci says. An unnamed person's attempt to manipulate information coming out of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention for political reasons has been unfortunate, White House Coronavirus Task Force member Dr. Anthony Fauci said Tuesday. The person who was trying to influence the CDC and even me with emails is gone, Fauci said at the Atlantic Festival. So I think we can put that behind us right now. Fauci appeared to be referring to Michael Caputo, who served as the Assistant for Public Affairs in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Caputo, who announced last week that he was taking a leave of absence, has been accused by critics of politicizing the CDC and HHS response to the pandemic and of trying to influence studies published in the CDC's journal, the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, to align with the Trump administration's position. When asked where Americans should go for trustworthy information on the coronavirus, Fauci replied, I would trust the CDC and I would trust the FDA. The FDA commissioner has made it very clear that he is going to make sure that in the trenches, scientists who look at these types of things all the time, that's what they do for a living, they're going to be the ones that are going to be making the recommendation about any potential coronavirus vaccine. Will a COVID-19 vaccine be announced on Trump administration's political timeline? Fauci says no. Asked if there will be a coronavirus vaccine on the Trump administration's political timeline, Dr. Fauci on Tuesday said no. The data will determine the announcement, Fauci said at the Atlantic Festival. Fauci explained that the data that's produced by a vaccine trial is monitored by its Data and Safety Monitoring Board. The only person who sees that data is the unblinded statistician on the Data Safety Monitoring Board, who's beholden to no one, not to the FDA, not to the president, not to me, and not to the company, he said. President Donald Trump has said on more than one occasion that there will be a vaccine available by Election Day in early November, a timeline that health officials, doctors involved in trials, and companies have said is unlikely. Fauci added, if someone tries to make an end run, that's going to be clearly obvious. Analysis. Trump again minimizes the pandemic as officials warn of a fall surge. A new clash between Donald Trump's political goals and his duties to public health threatens to deprive America of presidential leadership in the critical weeks that will decide if a second wave of COVID-19 swamps the country this winter. As the U.S. death toll from the pandemic passed 200,000, Dr. Fauci warned Tuesday that he is worried that the high base level of infections could make it difficult to keep the virus under control in the colder months. While the government's top infectious diseases specialist, who has been marginalized by Trump, said serious trouble was not inevitable, he added at the Citizen by CNN conference that it's not acceptable to not realize that we are entering into a risk period and we've got to act accordingly. Fauci spoke while medical indicators head in a perilous direction as the U.S. approaches its 7 millionth infection. Cases are rising in 24 states, Washington, D.C., and two territories. Wisconsin's Governor Tony Evers warned Tuesday of a new and dangerous stage of the pandemic in the crucial swing state, where Trump held a rally last week. And there are now more than 59,000 cases of coronavirus on college campuses after many schools decided to open despite adopting insufficient safety measures. Notre Dame canceled its football game on Saturday against Wake Forest after 7 Fighting Irish players tested positive for the virus. The move comes just a week after Trump claimed he had orchestrated the return of football for many of Notre Dame's Midwest and Battleground State neighbors in the Big Ten Conference. But there is no visible sign of concern from the White House about this potential pivot point on which thousands of lives may depend. That may be because it coincides with the moment of highest tension in a presidential race in which the president is trying to convince voters that the worst of the emergency has passed. I think we've done an amazing job. In my opinion, we're rounding the turn, the president said in an interview with a local Fox station in Detroit, in which he continued to minimize the danger. On Monday, he had claimed that the virus affects virtually nobody, a staggering comment on the eve of such a tragic milestone. Indoor winter gatherings could be extremely dangerous, doctor and writer say. Dr. James Hamblin, a staff writer at The Atlantic, said he's concerned about the upcoming winter during the coronavirus pandemic. When the cold and flu and the coronavirus all hit at the same time, it's a potential for a really potent mix, he said on CNN's New Day. Hamblin's suggestions for winter include accepting reality, planning for more shutdowns, and living like you are already contagious. The worst mistake we can make is to assume that because things are going well, or because a neighborhood or city where you are is opening, that's going to continue apace. It might level off. It might have to go back and shelter in place a little while, he said. Hamblin said that families should consider not gathering indoors for long periods of time during the holiday season, which could create an extremely dangerous situation. I would plan ahead to just try to create some new traditions this year, he said. Even if a vaccine is available, Hamlin said that should be taken along with bundling treatment and prevention of the virus, which includes wearing masks, social distancing, and testing protocols. As the U.S. surpasses 200,000 COVID-19 deaths, survivors have a message. This is not a hoax. Even as the United States surpasses 200,000 COVID-19 deaths, there are still people who think the coronavirus is a hoax. Survivors of the disease and members of victims' families beg to differ and are sharing their very real experiences with the deadly disease. Anne and Marvin Robinson, a married couple in Casper, Wyoming, got the virus almost 3 months ago. Marvin, 73, still has shortness of breath, and both are battling fatigue. We have friends who still believe it's a hoax. They think it's going to go away on Election Day. Anne, 72, told CNN's Brianna Kaler on Tuesday. It's trying to convince people that the 200,000 people who have died were important, Anne said of her efforts to assure people of the reality of the virus. Their friends kind of discount the fact that older people get it and they have underlying conditions, that they were going to die anyway, Anne said. Well, I'm an older person, and I have underlying conditions, and I intend to live a lot more years. 28-year-old doctor who died of COVID-19 was a role model, friends say. Friends of a 28-year-old doctor who died after a months-long battle with coronavirus remember her as a friendly, caring person who served as a role model for many. Adeline Fagan was a second-year OBGYN resident living in Houston. She developed COVID-19 symptoms in July, but didn't respond to treatments and was placed on a ventilator before she died. It's not something that you think of at 27, 28, that your friend dies, and that's kind of what's happening during this pandemic. We're seeing all these young adults getting infected by this virus. Dr. Catherine DeGuzman, a friend of Fagan's since medical school, said on CNN's Newsday, I have nightmares and wake up thinking that maybe this isn't real, but then I remind myself that it is, she added. Dr. Tiffany Lynn, another medical school friend, said that Fagan was a warm and caring person who went out of her way to help others. She always told us that it only takes a moment of kindness and a gesture to make someone feel better. She definitely proved that throughout medical school and as a person. Even when you were a stranger or her loved one, she had this really unique gift of making sure that you felt truly cared for, that you as a person mattered, Lynn said. Fagan would set up friend dates to get to know everyone in her class. She valued happiness on par with her studies, said Dr. Timothy Shubb. DeGuzman said that she will continue to look to Fagan as an example. She was pretty much my role model and who I wanted to become, DeGuzman said. She was just like someone I wanted to be, someone I still strive to be. Now we're going to bring you some pre-recorded reports. We begin with stories related to vaccines. We now bring you three stories that are related to distribution from NPR. The first, examining the ethics involved when distributing a COVID-19 vaccine. CDC urges states to be ready for COVID-19 vaccination distribution. And CDC discusses plan for distribution of a future coronavirus vaccine. Here are those reports.
Okay, here's a life or death question. Who gets the first doses of the coronavirus vaccine? To be clear, there's not a vaccine to argue about right now, but it's by no means too early to ask who gets priority in the early phase when a vaccine is approved, but there's not enough for everyone. Today, a CDC advisory committee is considering what to recommend. NPR's Ping Huang reports.
It's still unknown when a COVID-19 vaccine might be available in the U.S., but when it is, at first, there may only be 10 to 15 million doses available. That's according to Operation Warp Speed, the government's vaccine project, and it's just enough to cover about 3 to 5% of the U.S. population. Dr. Grace Lee, a medical officer at Stanford Children's Hospital who's also on the CDC committee, says there's a lot of people who could really benefit from it.
Those who have the highest risk of exposure, those who are at risk for severe morbidity and mortality.
Also, she says, people whose jobs are critical to keeping our healthcare systems and society running. And if you add those all together,
we are talking about a lot of people. This accounts for more than half of U.S. adults.
That's the CDC's Kathleen Dooling, presenting at last month's meeting of the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. The question before the committee is, when you only have vaccines for 3-5% of the population, who gets it first? Ruth Faden is a bioethicist at Johns Hopkins, consulting on the World Health Organization's vaccine guidelines. She represents a consensus when she says those first doses should go to frontline health workers who are directly exposed to COVID-19.
Obviously, they are being placed at high risk of infection because they're taking care of people who are infected and infectious.
But even within the seemingly clear category, there are questions about who a frontline health worker is. It's a doctor, a nurse. It's also hospital staff that care for and clean up after COVID patients. Faden says nursing home workers are in this category too.
They also are taking care of people who are vulnerable in many cases to serious disease and death if they contract COVID.
Preliminary guidelines from the CDC say it may also include pharmacy staff and emergency medical responders. A draft report from the National Academy of Sciences suggests that morticians and funeral home workers are also frontline health workers because they handle COVID victims' bodies. And if everyone who might qualify as a health worker exceeds the initial supply, Lee at Stanford says that state and local authorities might have to focus it more.
Healthcare worker vaccination sounds so simple, but if we don't have enough doses, we still have to be really judicious in how we're implementing.
This could mean restricting the vaccine to parts of a state that are being hit the hardest, for example. And that's just for the first 15 million doses. Within a few weeks, as manufacturing kicks into gear, more vaccines should be available. So, who gets it next? Does it go to essential workers who keep the buses running and the grocery shelves stocked? Does it go to the elderly or people with pre-existing conditions who are more likely to get very sick? Lee says a lot of the decisions will depend on the characteristics of the vaccine itself.
These recommendations are not in a vacuum. They are meant for the real world, and I think that's what makes it so complex.
Who does it work best in? Who can it reasonably be given to? Will people line up in droves to get it? It's information that's still unknown. But even if you're a healthy adult cloistered in your house waiting out the pandemic, Faden from Johns Hopkins says the line for the vaccine won't last forever.
In a reasonable period of time, if all goes well, we will have enough vaccine that's safe and effective for everyone in the country who wants one.
The National Academies suggests that a vaccine could be available to all Americans within 12 to 18 months of its approval. Ping Huang, NPR News.
When could we actually see an effective vaccine for the coronavirus? The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says it could be October. At least the agency is telling states they should have plans in place to distribute a vaccine at that point. The CDC director also reportedly sent a letter to governors asking them to fast-track permits and licenses so that vaccine distribution sites can be up and running by November 1st. To talk through what all this means, I'm joined by Dr. Ali Khan. He is the dean of the School of Public Health in Omaha, Nebraska. He was the director of the Office of Public Health Preparedness and Response at the CDC. He joins us this morning from Omaha. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning, Rachel. Thank you very much.
First off, Dr. Khan, what do states have to do to get distribution sites up and running for a vaccine? And then how is the CDC trying to hurry that process up?
So this is something that CDC is appropriately doing, which is making sure that the states are prepared. It's a complex process that involves how do you allocate vaccine, how do you distribute the vaccine, how do you administer the vaccine, how do you ensure equitable access for the vaccine. So CDC and the states do this all the time, for example, if there's a measles outbreak. But this is going to be a complex process to vaccinate potentially all Americans, and it's very appropriate to get the planning down and make sure that states are ready for receipt of vaccine.
So does telling states to be ready for distribution actually mean there's an effective one ready to go in a matter of weeks?
Not at all. And I think that's where the concern is. So I am pretty confident that we will have good science to finally make a decision on an efficacious vaccine with a good side effect profile. But the most important thing we need right now for vaccines is trust. You know, we've had an issue, as you know, with measles vaccine. And specifically for this vaccine, there's already a large group that says they don't want to get vaccinated. So trying to propose that there's going to be a vaccine available before the election actually may undermine people's trust in the process to develop an efficacious and safe vaccine.
Right. As you note, the timing is worth underscoring that this is expected to happen in early November, right before the election. I mean, can I ask more about what the process looks like? I mean, when we hear the CDC director talking to governors about fast-tracking permits and licenses, that's circumventing the normal process, right? I mean, those permits and licenses are there for a reason. So what is lost by doing that?
So I want to differentiate what the process is within the state to make sure that states are ready for vaccine distribution, as opposed to shortcutting or taking shortcuts for the vaccine process itself. So we know during the 2009 influenza outbreak that it took a very long time to make sure that Americans had vaccine available to them. The vaccine was available in December, and it was before April that we were able to vaccinate 25% of Americans. So I think CDC is appropriately reaching out to states and saying, please get your plans ready so that when vaccine is available, we can go right away and we're not left waiting to get vaccine into people's arms.
May I ask you, as a former CDC official, as the dean of the University of Nebraska School of Public Health, I mean, how have you been observing the research around vaccines? Are you optimistic that we could see an effective one in a matter of, I mean, we're really just talking about weeks at this point?
So I'm very optimistic about a vaccine and potentially more than one vaccine. I do not believe that this is going to be ready in a matter of weeks. We know the phase three trials. There's currently three phase three trials that are enrolling approximately 30,000 people. And I think it will be October, November before we start to see the results of those studies. And hopefully there's a vaccine that's really very, very good and has a good safety profile and we can start sooner than later. But I think it's super optimistic to think that we're going to be ready in October with the vaccine.
Dr. Ali Khan, he was the director of the Office of Public Health Preparedness and Response at the CDC. He is currently the dean of the School of Public Health at the University of Nebraska in Omaha, which is where he joined us from. Dr. Khan, thank you so much for your perspective. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Mask on.
Mask on.
There have been mixed messages out of Washington today about the timing of a coronavirus vaccine. CDC Director Robert Redfield told lawmakers on Capitol Hill that it likely won't be widely available until the summer or autumn of next year. Later, President Trump said the rollout would be much faster. But the thing is, finding a safe and effective vaccine might turn out to be easy compared to the monumental task of getting a large number of Americans vaccinated. NPR Pharmaceuticals correspondent Sydney Lupkin has been reporting on the Trump administration's vaccine distribution plan, and she's here to walk us through what she found. Hey, Sydney.
Hey, Elsa.
So what are public health officials up against? Like, what are the challenges involved in distributing a vaccine?
A big challenge is uncertainty. We don't know which of the vaccines will be okayed by the FDA or when, and they're all different. Operation Warp Speed includes six different vaccines at various stages of clinical testing. The two that seem most likely to be ready first are from Pfizer and Moderna. They're stored at different temperatures, require different kinds of preparation by the healthcare provider. These vaccines would require two doses, but shots of the Pfizer vaccine would be 21 days apart. For Moderna, we expect it to be 28 days. Mm-hmm. And we need to be sure that a patient getting the first dose of, say, the Pfizer vaccine doesn't accidentally get a dose of the Moderna vaccine because right. they're not interchangeable. Paul Mango is the Deputy Chief of Staff for Policy at HHS.
This is a really a quite extraordinary, logistically complex undertaking. And a lot of uncertainties right now. I think the message we want you to leave with is we are prepared for all of those.
Okay, so how are they preparing right now?
Today, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention put out what it's calling an interim playbook for vaccination. It touches on storing, shipping, and distributing a coronavirus vaccine, as well as an IT system to keep track of everything. And this is a huge collaborative effort. For starters, you've got two federal agencies, the CDC and the Department of Defense. Mm-hmm. Then the federal government needs to coordinate with states and territories. And of course, private companies come into play as well. So Operation Warp Speed is coming up with different possible scenarios and doing tabletop exercises to practice.
I mean, this is extremely complicated. And just to be clear, we're not all going to get the vaccine at once, right? So how is this distribution going to roll out?
Well, we know that once the FDA greenlights a vaccine, there won't be enough to give it to 300 million Americans. But by the end of the year, there could be tens of millions of doses if things go right. Still, the government is going to have to prioritize. The plan is that healthcare workers, people with underlying medical conditions, the elderly, and essential workers will be first. As for everyone else, the CDC director, Robert Redfield, told the Senate committee this morning that most Americans wouldn't receive a COVID-19 vaccine until summer or early autumn of 2021. However, later in the day, President Trump contradicted that timeline. He told White House reporters he thinks the CDC director was confused and that distribution could start as soon as October and is going to go much faster.
Okay, so what do other public health experts think of this distribution plan so far?
I mean, the reception has been somewhat mixed. People are happy to see a plan, but would like it to include more detail. Former CDC Director Tom Frieden says preparation is good. It's a good thing. But he expected this kind of document a couple months ago. He's glad that McKesson, a large drug distributor, was tapped to help with the vaccine logistics. It proved that it could do this work during H1N1, swine flu, back in 2009.
They delivered more than 120,000 deliveries to nearly 80,000 delivery points, refrigerated and without a glitch.
But it took them 4 months to scale up. He's also concerned about having a sophisticated plan to build public trust, considering so many Americans are skeptical of a coronavirus vaccine.
If we have a safe and effective vaccine, we need to handle it right, not just in terms of the temperature, but in terms of the trust, so that it can be preserved and used and protective, not only in this country, but around the world.
So we'll see what happens.
That is NPR pharmaceutical correspondent Sydney Lupkin. Thank you, Sydney.
You bet.
When a COVID-19 vaccine becomes available in the United States, there won't be enough doses for everyone right away. So who should get it first? That is the big question facing a committee advising the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC. That committee met today to consider vaccine distribution and vaccine safety. NPR's Ping Huang is keeping track of this. Hello again, Ping.
Hello, Mary Louise.
So who is this committee? Who's in the group? What's their role?
Yeah, so the group is called the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, and this is a group of experts that reviews every vaccine the FDA approves. It's a federal advisory group that's been around for decades, and they make recommendations to the CDC director about things like who should get a vaccine and how frequently it should be given out. They usually meet 3 times a year, but since we're in a pandemic, they're now meeting every month to discuss the issues around a COVID-19 vaccine.
Okay, so today was the day. They had this all-day meeting online, of course. What was the agenda?
Yeah, so today they focused on a couple things. They focused on safety, on equity, and they also raised concerns about vaccine hesitancy. The group got a presentation from one of its members on what's happening to ensure that a vaccine that is approved is safe. And, you know, there have been concerns in the public about, is this something that's being rushed? Dr. Robert Atmar from Baylor College of Medicine is a committee member, and here he is at the meeting today.
We want the public to be reassured that any vaccine that is has gone through the appropriate review.
And they didn't just talk about the safety of the vaccine. They also talked about ensuring the safety of vaccination sites. One member of the committee, Paul Hunter from the city of Milwaukee, mentioned that threats against Milwaukee's health commissioner led her to resign. So a CDC rep said that safety at vaccine sites is important, and they'll be adding those considerations in their game plans for states.
Wow, so many things to think about there. Okay, meanwhile, they were expected to vote today, trying to prioritize who would get a vaccine first. They delayed the vote. How come?
Yeah, so the committee had initially planned to vote, as you mentioned, on which priority groups should get a COVID-19 vaccine first, but today they said they just don't have the information right now. The committee is considering four groups that are disproportionately affected by COVID-19. It's healthcare workers that care for COVID-19 patients, it's essential workers, and it's older people who have a higher risk of dying if they get the disease, and it's also people with medical conditions like cancer or obesity who could get very sick from getting it. Underscoring all of this is the issue of equity. The data shows very clearly that Black, Latino, and Native populations have been bearing the brunt of sickness and death when it comes to the pandemic. And if these communities can't get these vaccines, they will continue to suffer the most impacts from COVID-19.
So just briefly, what exactly are they looking for to try to figure out who will get the first vaccines?
Yeah, so the committee is looking for data that's coming out from phase 3 clinical trials that are currently underway. Here's Grace Lee, a pediatrics professor at Stanford and a committee member at today's meeting.
So for example, if the benefit risk balance in adults over 65 looks quite different than in younger adults, that might influence the ordering and vice versa.
They're also looking for information on how a vaccine needs to be stored, and it's also going to be important to know how many doses will be available and when. That information is currently unknown, but as soon as the vaccine is approved, the committee will have an emergency meeting to finalize recommendations.
All right. Thank you, Ping.
Thank you so much.
And NPR's Ping Huang.
Now here's an article or a recorded story about why coronavirus vaccine trials need large numbers of volunteers.
200,000 people in the U.S. have now died from COVID-19, and scientists around the world are racing to develop a vaccine to prevent the disease. So far, they've enrolled more than 100,000 volunteers to test the leading vaccine candidates. NPR science correspondent Joe Palca has been looking into how we will know whether a vaccine is truly effective and when we might have that answer. Hi, Joe.
Hello.
First off, would you recap for us why we need so many people in these trials?
Well, one of the reasons is you want to be able to look for rare side effects. I mean, the initial trials involve tens or maybe hundreds of people, and there are sometimes side effects that only show up when you look at a lot of people. But the other thing is you need to make sure people get exposed, and this is where things get really interesting, because researchers can't go out and tell people, yes, now we've given you a shot, go see if you can get exposed to the virus. That would be unethical. I spoke with Ruth Caron, director of the Johns Hopkins Vaccine Initiative, and she says volunteers will be told to do all the things that will keep them healthy: hand washing, wearing a mask, social distancing.
Some people will not be able to adhere to that, and some people will have exposure just by the nature of the kind of work they do. For example, it could be if they're healthcare workers or if they're other kinds of frontline workers.
And also they need a lot of people because the trials will have two groups, people who actually get the vaccine and people who just get an injection with an inert liquid like saline.
And since there are those two different groups, how do you know that the vaccine is responsible for people not getting ill? I mean, maybe more people in the vaccinated group just never left their homes and so had no contact with anyone who could expose them to the virus.
Exactly. Well, that's a possibility. But there are two good reasons why that doesn't happen. First of all, there's something called double blind, which I'm sure you heard of. It means when you get jabbed in this study, you don't know what you're getting jabbed with, and the person doing the jabbing doesn't know what he or she is giving you. So there's no basis for changing your behavior based on whether or not you think you got the vaccine or didn't think you got the vaccine. But the other thing is something called randomization. And yes, okay, there'll be some people will be hermits, and there'll some people will go out with a devil-may-care attitude, and they'll expose themselves. But the idea with randomization is those people will be equally distributed between the vaccine group and the placebo group. And so you get the same numbers doing the same sorts of things, and so you can make a meaningful comparison between the two groups.
And then how do researchers know if anyone's actually being exposed to the virus?
Well, the truth is you don't in an individual case. You're making a bet that with a lot of people being out in the world, some people will be exposed. And you want to test the vaccine in a place where there are people, where the virus is circulating. But the other thing is you have to wait until you get a certain number of results. They call it events in the trial lingo, the number of people getting sick. And this is why big numbers are needed, because if you get the first 10 people and they all turn out to be in the control, in the placebo group, you say, oh, the vaccine's working, that's fantastic. but it may be a statistical fluke, and the next 10 people might be all in the vaccinated group who get sick. So you really have to wait until you get a certain number of cases, and in this, in these studies, they think that number is around 150 cases of disease, and then they'll look to see, well, how do those match out between the control group, the placebo group, and the people who actually get vaccinated.
Joe, is there any way to show that a vaccine works without involving so many people?
Well, there is a way. You can do what's called a challenge trial, where you actually take the virus after you vaccinated somebody, you take the virus and put it into their nose. But this has got ethical issues with it, because you don't have a treatment, and if they get sick, you could actually be killing people in your trial. So you're kind of betting that the vaccine will work, and some people feel that's not really ethical to do.
That is NPR science correspondent Joe Palca. Joe, thank you.
You're welcome.
Now we're going to bring you two opinion pieces that were published in the Midland Reporter Telegram, read by our volunteers recently, that we didn't have time to include in the newspaper broadcast. One is about acquired herd immunity. The other opinion piece is Congress must keep frontline workers on the job.
This column is called Guest View. It is entitled, Naturally Acquired Herd Immunity is a Terrible Strategy. From the Star Tribune, Minneapolis. The controversial appointment of a new presidential medical advisor has put a national spotlight on a radical disease management concept to deal with the COVID-19 pandemic. Its benign name, Naturally Acquired Herd Immunity, belies the cruelty at the heart of this approach. A better descriptor would be, do nothing and let the virus kill off the weak plan. Eventually, COVID-19 would stop spreading because there would be enough survivors of the infection, the herd, and they presumably would have some immune system protection against the pathogen. But this could come at an unacceptable cost, potentially millions of deaths in those with underlying health conditions that make them susceptible to severe infection. Last week, the new White House medical advisor, Dr. Scott Atlas, forcefully pushed back on reports that he is advocating policies rooted in this approach. The neuroradiologist said this is an overt lie during a Tuesday CNN interview. That rejection is welcome. While other countries have considered variations of this strategy, or even pursued it unsuccessfully, letting the virus run its course is a deeply flawed approach. It should not be taken seriously by the nation's policymakers, especially with the rapid strides underway in vaccine development. A safe, effective vaccine would provide population-wide protection. Experts are hopeful that one could be widely available in 2021. But if there are setbacks, herd immunity should not be considered a fallback approach. While herd immunity persists as a social media talking point and was recently mentioned by President Donald Trump in an interview, leading infectious disease doctors in Minnesota and elsewhere do not support the naturally acquired herd immunity approach. Dr. Anthony Fauci, the venerable director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, told Politico this week that neither he nor White House advisor Dr. Deborah Birx backed this strategy. The Infectious Diseases Society of America, or IDSA, which represents over 12,000 physicians and scientists, told an editorial writer this week that IDSA is not supportive of the herd immunity approach to addressing this pandemic. Experts at the Mayo Clinic and the University of Minnesota are critical. One fundamental concern, said Mayo's Dr. Pratish Tosh, is that it's not clear how long immune protection lasts in people who have been infected with COVID. Protection from other viruses in the same family isn't long-lasting, he said. Yet assuming otherwise for COVID-19 is at the heart of the naturally acquired herd immune strategy, and that's an assumption I don't think we can make, he said. The University of Minnesota's Dr. Tim Shacker called naturally acquired herd immunity a terrible strategy, noting the potentially huge cost to human life for an approach that may or may not work. Shacker also rejected one rationale for herd immunity, that the vulnerable could simply isolate. High blood pressure, obesity, and underlying health concerns that increase the risk of severe COVID are common. Putting an indefinite bubble around everyone with these conditions, along with the elderly, isn't doable. Both Tosh and Shacker also noted that those who are infected and recover from COVID may have serious long-term complications. One concern, heart damage. The case against naturally acquired herd immunity is strong. There are those who still may embrace it because they believe it would bolster the economy. But the evidence for this is weak. Sweden, which relied on a voluntary COVID containment with the aim of developing herd immunity, has fared better economically than some European Union countries, but has the highest unemployment rate among Nordic nations. Sweden also came in eighth in a recent global ranking of mortality rates per million. Further evidence of the high and unacceptable price tag inherent in this herd immunity approach. This column is distributed by Tribune Content Agency.
Commentary. Congress must keep frontline workers on the job. By Lee Saunders, InsideSources.com. On the first Monday of every September, we celebrate the selflessness and sacrifice of all working people. But this year, the Labor Day tribute takes on an even greater weight. Because this year, during the worst public health crisis in a century, working people are rising to the moment in new, extraordinary ways. Week after grueling week, in the face of adversity and uncertainty, essential workers, so many of them proud union members, have stood fearlessly on the front lines. Public service workers in particular, nurses and EMTs, corrections officers and sanitation workers, school custodians and child care providers, among many others, have led the nation's coronavirus response and recovery efforts. They have answered the call in our community's hour of most desperate need, putting the health and safety of their neighbors first. They have done so under the most difficult and dangerous conditions, often without personal protective equipment, even when it meant exposing themselves and their families to risk. If only some politicians in Washington, D.C. had half the courage. Instead, a majority of U.S. senators has shown callous indifference by refusing to pass a stimulus bill that will throw a lifeline to working families and communities. With the COVID-19 death toll approaching 200,000 and the economy in meltdown, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, President Trump's most reliable enabler, is choosing, in his words, to push the pause button. The result is being felt by Americans in every community. Less trash pickup, fewer people to process unemployment claims, a slowdown in essential public services we all need to survive this pandemic. And make no mistake, Trump and McConnell are to blame. Working people don't want to push the pause button. We want to fight this pandemic and get our economy moving. But right now, when people in public service are needed on the job most, too many are being thanked with pink slips as states and localities confront devastating fiscal crises. To avoid more layoffs and furloughs, we need a robust package of federal aid to states, cities, towns, and schools. Without this state and local aid, if Congress fails to fund the front lines, the essential services that sustain our communities are on the chopping block. That means dilapidated roads, dirtier water coming out of the tap, and longer waits for an ambulance when you call 911. It means our hospitals are overwhelmed and understaffed. It means our schools don't have the resources to educate our children and keep them safe. Without this aid, everything that makes our neighborhoods safe and strong is compromised. Without it, we will see widespread job loss in both the private and public sectors. There should be nothing divisive or controversial about this. Experts on the left and right agree this aid is the key to jump-starting the economy and preventing this recession from becoming a depression. It is an investment that would more than pay for itself, with each dollar of aid generating $1.70 in economic activity. Governors and mayors of both parties have lobbied aggressively for it, as has virtually every nonpartisan association of state and local elected officials. Aid to states, cities, towns, and schools isn't just good policy, it's also good politics. Public support for funding the front lines is overwhelming, 84% strong. And that is where the rubber will meet the road on Election Day 2 months from now, if obstruction from the Senate continues. Americans will know exactly which elected officials failed to lead in this do-or-die moment, which ones were indifferent to public health, which ones ignored economic imperatives. Voters will hold them accountable and deliver a rude wake-up call on the morning of November 4th. What hangs in the balance is the health of our people, the vitality of our communities, and the fundamentals of our economy. Working people defend and fortify these pillars. That is what makes labor strong. This Labor Day, more than any other, let us all extend our gratitude to these everyday heroes. When the challenges are greatest, when the stakes are highest, that is when they are at their best. Lee Saunders is president of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. Distributed by Tribune Content Agency.
And that is your coronavirus update for this Wednesday, September 23rd, 2020. I'm Michael from the Recording Library of West Texas. Here's what's coming up today. We'll bring you national news at 2 o'clock from USA Today. Then at 3 o'clock, our local volunteers will be reading our newspapers. Here are some of the articles they'll be reading today. From the Midland Reporter-Telegram, coronavirus pandemic has put stress on daily life. Planning and zoning OKs Summit Petroleum's office development. Commissioners approve zone change to allow for office retail development with green space. And council passes resolution supporting the city of Midland opening for business. From the Odessa American, county's 2020-21 budget okayed. Rodriguez opposes higher tax rate. Nurse of the year loves caring for kids. And Sheriff's Tahoe's delivery slowed. Production problems, high demand are factors. Those articles and more from our local papers at 3 o'clock. At 6 o'clock, international, national, and business news from the Wall Street Journal. And at 7 o'clock tonight, we'll bring you our Centers Solutions podcast. One note about the podcast is you may have noticed that for the last few weeks, they have been encore presentations of earlier aired podcasts. That's because our hosts have not been producing them, but they are resuming production of the podcast this week, and they will be back with a new one next week. But tonight, we're bringing you an encore presentation of one of the more interesting podcasts that they have produced during the pandemic. And it relates to some of the things that we've been presenting here this past hour. Tonight's podcast will be with a frontline worker, a Midland doctor, Dr. Merritt. She'll be discussing what it's like to treat patients on the front lines and other things related to the pandemic. That's at 7 o'clock tonight on our Centers Solutions podcast. Thank you. Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today. Followed by the Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American at 3.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland, Odessa area. It's 76 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the upper 60s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the upper 80s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 70s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 2 p.m.
This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Liz Hill, and this is USA Today. First article of the morning is titled, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg Returns to Supreme Court for Final Time. Written by Richard Wolfe. Associate Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg was to return to the Supreme Court for the final time Wednesday, under circumstances both she and her legions